Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
Hey everyone, this is your host, Bobby Mason, and I wanted to welcome you back to the Master the Start podcast presented by GoMahi.com. This is episode number 28. We're already 28 in. Where does the time go? Today, we have John Ozzie Nelson Jr. on the show, and I can't tell you why. I mean, I can. I'm about to tell you in the summary. I absolutely love sitting down with Ozzie. He is an absolute beast, and he just figures out how to do business right. This is definitely one of my favorite episodes of Master the Start, so please settle in and listen to the entire podcast. So, quick summary before we jump in. Who is John Ozzie Nelson Jr.? Known as Ozzie, you're going to find out why there was that name change at the beginning of the show. Anyways, Ozzie is an accomplished global business leader who has demonstrated a commitment to the design industry and the community. As co-CEO of Nelson, Ozzie has guided the firm to unprecedented growth and an industry ranking as the third largest provider of design and design-related services to corporate America. In 2015, Nelson was named amongst Interior Design Magazine's 2015 Top 100 Giants, coming in at number 9. The firm also retained its spot as number 5 on the magazine's list of Top 10 Office Giants. Now, Nelson, going to Ozzie here, he in the past has been a trustee and two-time board chair of Students Today, Leaders Forever, a nonprofit organization that was recognized by Time Magazine as one of the top 10 ways to give back. So settle in. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or Google Play. Also, most importantly, I'll probably say it at the end of the podcast too, check out our social links. Check us out on Instagram at Master the Start, Twitter at Master the Start, LinkedIn at Master the Start, Facebook at Master the Start. We're creating a whole lot of content for all of you so you can learn more and more every single week. And this is content created and designed around our lovely guests that we have on the show. Most importantly, like always, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Master the Start. And I'll talk to you after the show.
Well, Ozzie, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it. Before we even start, I need to ask, how do you get Ozzie from John?
So I was a junior, and I was never John. At best, I was Johnny, and at worst, I was little Johnny. So I had went to French class one day. I had a substitute teacher. I was in ninth grade, and she asked if I was any relation to Ozzie and Harriet, the TV show from the 50s. And it followed, as a hockey player, followed me to practice. I was like, well, you know, it's better than little Johnny. And, you know, the other bend in the story is when I went to St. Thomas, I arrived to St. Thomas and I knew nobody. I come from Philadelphia and, my hockey coach was from Minnesota and that's how I got here, but knew no one. And I ran for freshman class president and won. And I am completely convinced it was the name because I just did not know enough people. So, it has served me well. There's a certain curiosity about Ozzie Nelson, and so here I am.
All right, cool. So who is Ozzie Nelson? That's just a quick summary. I know you can't get in depth, or else we'll be here all day.
You know, I think I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a father of three. I'm going on 32 years of married to a woman that I met in freshman orientation. So there's a real core value morality side of me. And on the other side, there's a ever-changing, ever-reaching person that that kind of enjoys an environment that's constantly changing.
Cool. What is, I'll let you sip that coffee because I cut you off last time. So what is Nelson Company?
So the company started as an interior design company almost 40 years ago, or over 40 years ago, 42 years ago, and has evolved to be Nelson Worldwide Holdings is a company that's a holding company for two different companies. One is Brinjac Engineering. Brinjac Engineering is about a $10 million company today, and we have great ambitions for that company. In fact, I have a new president who's going to be announced next week who will look to grow that company 400% over the next 5 years. And the main company is Nelson Worldwide, which is design, architecture, environmental graphics, and consulting. So over the last 15 years, we've done over 40 merger acquisitions, all targeted at aggregately creating a company that would do a couple of things. One, we'd have a network in every U.S. city. We are not in Phoenix and we are not in Denver, but short of that, we're pretty much in every U.S. city. Two, we'd have the size and scale to be able to be a player at a high level in the industry. So today we're about a $190 million company. And thirdly, we wanted to diversify ourselves after the downturn. It's like going to CEO boot camp. It was a, you know, you either get bitter at experiences like that or you see them as opportunities for tremendous growth. And for me, it's really an opportunity to reinvent going from just purely a growth guy to a true CEO who understood there's a growth lever, but there's also an expense lever, and that sometimes you really have to balance the two. So coming out of the downturn, what I decided was that my crystal ball was no better than anybody else's, and so I needed to have a series of verticals that could offset each other no matter where the world went. So today, we have kept our position in corporate interior design. So we're number three in service to corporate America. But in the last acquisition that we made, we bought a company that's number three in consumer brand and retail design. We're one of the largest, if not the largest, providers of tenant planning services, which means that when you go to many of the high-rises in the Twin Cities or in New York or in Atlanta, we're actually the company that the landlord calls when the tenant is interested in coming in the building or wants to modify somehow. So that allows us that when the downturn happens, leases still expire, corporate America still has needs. So we want to be able to be economically sustainable, and we also want to be large enough that in any one of those verticals we can be top three.
Jeez. You really diversified.
Yes, we have.
So to go back to the original design aspect, I'm really curious about how do you design your spaces? Now, what I mean by that is I think a lot of people think you're just designing a pretty space, but I have to believe that you're designing something that goes beyond that because every space has a function, whether it's an innovation lab or a retail store. One location, you want to have someone buy something. The other one, you want to create good ideas. How do you design around that?
Yeah, so I think the latest verbiage around that would be I would take the word function and I would replace it with experience. And, you know, design for years was about form following function. Today, whether you go to the ballpark or you go to the classroom or you go to the office, it's all about how do you create experiences and how does the architecture and the other elements contribute to that experience. So we really kind of step way back to say what kinds of experiences do we want to create and what's your budget and what's your brand. And so starting with what your brand is, for instance, if your brand is about being an innovator, then that space is going to take a direction that's very transparent, high tech, you know, all of those other things. If you're a more conservative company, how do we translate conservatism into something that's relevant? Because I think increasingly we're seeing that the more traditional thing, you know, a lot of traditional enterprises, whether they're law firms or financial institutions, all, you know, they don't want to be perceived as being behind an opaque wall that nobody can see. And today, I think a lack of transparency translates into a lack of trust. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what kind of experience do you want your customers to have? What is your brand? And really, how do we use the physical environment to translate it into your brand and the experience you're looking for your customers to have. Hmm.
So you kind of act more as a, and you act as a consultant too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we are far more consulting based today as a discipline and as an industry than purely designers or architects.
Well, before I ask my other questions, but I need to ask, now that you told me what you actually majored in, how does someone that majors in marketing get into design?
Yeah. So I entered my father's, I got my degree at University of St. Thomas, and I went into my father's 14-person interior design firm. And, you know, it's been an interesting journey. I think the most frustrating moments for me have been being in an industry that thought so differently. I think my greatest opportunities have been being in an industry that thinks so differently. So the early days, very challenging because boutique design firms historically have thought in a way that was very design-centric without incorporating all the things I just talked to you about, which is what's the brand, what's the... So it was purely a largely aesthetic approach to meeting a client's needs. So 2 years into it, I was about to leave. I thought it was the craziest thing I'd ever done. And we had an opportunity. So corporate America, when I joined my father's firm, which was in 1987, corporate America had a lot of in-house interior designers and architects, because the belief was, why buy it outside? We can do it a lot cheaper inside and have control. And then they woke up and said, you know, then that was the beginning of businesses thinking about what's our core competency. And obviously, you know, for an insurance company, design isn't a core competency. So they started outsourcing those functions. And that was when the firm went through its first growth spurt, because I saw this opportunity to create outsourced design groups to each of these corporations, and in fact even put them on site. So where the traditional designers thought, oh my gosh, how would we possibly have our people on site with the client? And, you know, so the difference in training, I think, allowed me to see those early opportunities. And then the other piece was that in the early 90s, I worked with a couple of technical guys in the firm to develop a bi-directional link between a database and a new software called AutoCAD. And that would allow corporations to track occupancy. So when you think about a company that has millions and millions of square feet, they need some kind of way of keeping track of it. And this allowed them to dynamically keep track of it. But it also put us in a very strategic role with our clients, because now we started to know their space better than they did. And when they wanted to push space around, we were able to not only push the space around, but then say, well, we could do that project for you. So we from the very beginning, again, I think because my background was so different, we looked at a lot of these consultative services that had stickiness with the client that would ultimately result in design, but we weren't necessarily out there competing first for design.
Makes a lot of sense. Is that... During that time in your early days, is that when you approached Bank of America, or you were working alongside, or how did that work?
Yeah, so that was, every success story has a lot of dumb luck to it. So there was a guy that when I lived in Philadelphia, the firm was based in Philadelphia, I met with a guy in Philadelphia who got a job with a company called Maryland National Bank, and Maryland National Bank would go on to do one of the largest Intermarket regional mergers ever done. We used this technology that I was talking about to not only help them push the space around, but to help them implement hundreds of projects when the two banks came together. And then Maryland National Bank fell into hard times, got acquired by Nations Bank. Nations Bank became Bank of America. But when Nations Bank came in and acquired them and used our tools, they said, at that time, that was the 14th merger they had done, and it was the smoothest from an occupancy standpoint. So that kind of started the mid-leg of my career, which was we now became standard operating procedure for Bank of America. And Bank of America, I joke that my business plan was to wait till Labor Day, And every Labor Day, Bank of America would buy another bank. And we'd get a call, and they'd say, go to Florida, we just bought Burnett. Go to New England, we just bought Sweet. Go to the West Coast, we just saw Bank of America. And it was actually Nations Bank that bought Bank of America and then took their name. So for 10 years, it was really a sweet gig. I mean, we had no marketing, no overhead. The firm was growing like 20% a year, highly profitable. And then the wall that we hit was that then corporate America started to bring in strategic sourcing people. And the strategic sourcing people didn't want to hear about our relationship. They wanted to hear about how many dots on the map do we have and what's our size and scale and why are we working with you when you're not one of the biggest in the industry. So that was really what pushed us then to start the whole merger acquisition growth strategy, because we looked objectively of what the market was going to require of us, and that would really shape the next 10 years.
Yeah, so I'd like to talk about the mergers, because you had a, as you termed it, your non-cash formula that you used. And I'm curious what this non-cash formula is, because I want to use it.
Well, you know, so much of this is about being creative. And I think, you know, if you think of a lot of these stories of people that are successful, you know, at the time, I think one thing that was frustrating for me is that we didn't have a lot of resources. What I'm proud of now is how, without a lot of resources, you know, we were able to be creative. So I started to approach companies that were, at the time we were about 12 million, I started to approach companies that were about 2 million, which felt like we were a lot bigger. We had already built at 12 million accounting, HR, all the functions that we planned to be able to support at a larger scale. So I came to them and said, look, if you look at your growth over the last 3 years, you're flat. And the reality is you're probably going to stay flat unless you do something. And number two, all this pressure is coming down for you to even be bigger, and you don't necessarily know how to get there. So let's come together. Today you make, you know, $100,000 and you get a $50,000 bonus. So let's come together. Let's create NewCo. And in the beginning, the first negotiation was how much of NewCo would they own. So the first deal literally was $49.51. Over a series of deals, we'd be able to get to like a 25-75 split on the equity side. And then I'd say, so we come together. You keep your $100,000 salary. In fact, you get an employment agreement that you'll have that for 5 years. And the first $50,000 of profit that comes from this entity, whether it's your legacy customers or my new customers or all new customers, you get the first $50,000 draw. Now you're even. So if you can get $1 over that, I had something to do with getting you there. So let's split the first dollar over $50,000 based on what our equity split is. So it allowed me to come in the first couple of deals. I was getting my name attached to an entity. I was getting control of the entity. I was making a big bet because I didn't get anything if we didn't get $1 over. But there was a pretty good chance, even with some of the backroom consolidation and all that, that we would. Yeah. And as we went on to negotiate from there, you know, I was getting 80% or 75% of every incremental dollar over the base. And they were happy because they were getting 25% of something is better than 100% of nothing.
Yeah.
So that was the approach. And then we started, then after that, we got into our first asset-based lending agreement. And so asset-based lending usually is designed for like manufacturing companies. So the bank says, you buy a bunch of photocopiers, we'll lend you the money for the photocopier, and as you sell copier and sell it, you pay down the, so there's kind of a revolver around an asset. We found a bank that was willing to look at our accounts receivable and our WIP as our asset, which was really kind of a breakthrough for us. So then we were able to approach companies and actually be able to pay them for their receivables right when we closed the transaction. So we were actually able to write some kind of check at the table. And we just continued to improvise as, you know, until we got to a point where we had to go to mezz debt and get some debt to be able to actually write checks to do deals.
Gotcha. So 40 mergers. It's a lot.
And they come with 40 stories. I feel like Boyd Hooper, the guy from... I had 10,000 merges.
So how many of those 40 failed? Did any?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm working on a very small one, working out of a very small one now. I would say in terms of ones, I would say there are a number of them that were marginally successful. I say to people, there's a lot of Aussieisms, I say to people all the time, where are you in the journey? And I kind of use the ladder as an example. So, when you're standing on the first rung of the ladder, it's the most important rung there is. The higher up the ladder you go, the less important the first one becomes. And my point is that, how you measure success really depends on where you are in the journey. So those early mergers, just the fact that we were able to build the network that we needed, we were able to attach our name to those, we were able to, not have to cut a check and be able to get some profits, that was a level of success. And I would say that by that measure, all of the first, 12 or so were successful. What was unsuccessful about them is that these were smaller organizations. Many of the leaders didn't have the vision. They were seduced by the opportunity without necessarily having the vision. So there was this constant struggle between the local organization and the mothership, if you will, or the kind of company-wide brand and objectives. There are probably three where we lost money, where it just turned south so quick that, in fact, I show all the time, one of them was in Seattle, where we bought a company that, and in all those cases, what I misjudged was how quickly the industry was changing and how irrelevant the firm was becoming. And, design and architecture is such that it's gone from, you sit back and people come and say, oh, I saw the space you did, and we'd like you to do our space, to you are out there all the time being very aggressive in the marketplace, and that's how you get on the lists. So if you buy a firm that's waiting for people to come to them as opposed to able to be out and telling your story, it's not a pretty picture. And in like two or three times, I misjudged where those firms were and their irrelevance in the marketplace, if you will. But it was one in Seattle where they, right after they got acquired, they got all this swag and they sent me this really cool jacket that had Nelson on it. And so I love that jacket. And then the next year I realized that jacket cost me $1 million. So in every wear, I'm trying to get the cost per wear down.
Yeah, that's an expensive jacket.
Got to keep your sense of humor in all situations. It's the best remedy.
So you brought up the economic downturn, which I think is amazing that you had two options that you explained, and you essentially decided to really go for it and grow. So number one, how did you handle that pressure and decide to grow instead of kind of sit back? Number two, you said that was essentially CEO school. What were the two or three major takeaways you had as CEO? What was that school?
I think the first is that I thought I could grow myself out of anything. And in the beginning, I just thought I could redirect my attentions and get more involved in the sales. And it's probably the first time that I'd ever experienced just the faucets being turned off as tightly as they were, and there was no way that we were going to grow our way out of it. So once you face that reality, the second was, just face all of the realities that are coming your way. As gut-wrenching as it is, this is all about doing overall following where your energy comes from and where your passions are, And that has a lot to do with the entrepreneurialism and the vision and the overall direction of companies. And then you have to be willing to make the hard decisions and face the hard facts. And So, you know, whether the hard facts were how tight our liquidity had become. I mean, I sat in the back of the cab in New York City, and we had started to make, which is, you know, mistake number one, death by a thousand cuts. You know, the company started, at that point, was a $53 million company. The trend line was dropping. It looked like it was going to be, you know, dropped to 51, so then we cut to 51, and then it looked like it was going to 49, so then we cut to 49, and that just creates this environment of great instability for everybody. So I sat in this cab in the back of the cab in New York City, and I, on the back of a napkin, I like listed out the accounts that I knew that we really could count on, and I got to 38 million. And I got to the office, and I called my CFO, and I said, "Here's 38. I don't think we can miss 38." So we cut the organization to 38, which meant we had to cut hundreds of heads, and damned if we didn't. We 38-2, I think, is what our number was that year. I learned an awful lot about dealing with financial institutions, especially when a company, especially when the environment is challenging and a organization is not performing, your credibility is really on the line. And so really assessing a plan that you can deliver on and really putting yourself in the lender's position and working with them and being transparent, it's that in and of itself is an art. And I never forgot how important it is to, I think times get good and you lose touch with your lenders and then you have to go and have a conversation with them when times are bad. And it's like, oh, he's here, must be bad times. So ever since then, I've had a great rigor in terms of updating our lenders, at least having an annual meeting with them, sharing the vision with them, so that when we do have challenging times, we can point specifically to what has not happened and just as importantly, what we're doing about it.
So you grew pretty significantly from 2016 to 2017, correct?
That's correct. We, I think we went from, around that time, we went from 40 to 80 million, and from like 300 people to 600 people.
And then 2017 to 2018?
From 100 million to, slightly under 100 million to 175.
Some pretty impressive growth. And I would assume, and I heard you say this, that you refer to your company as a 1,200 person startup.
Yes, I do.
Which I think is really important because that means you're very agile.
Absolutely.
How would you say that attributes to this crazy growth and creating a culture that people can actually grasp onto when you're bringing this many people on board?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And it's worth saying that, you know, this is a year in which we are slowing the growth. I think it's important to slow the growth. And I'm finding that at every size there are, as I had hoped, very different organic opportunities. So, you know, it is important after these quantum leaps to take a deep breath, to take a perspective of where you are and how well the processes, procedures, and people match this new size and scale. I would say that I think there's some, first of all, right now we are going through a complete reevaluation of how we're organized. I changed my CFO about 10 months ago and brought somebody on who's really done some things at this size and scale. As to keeping, you know, I think there's two answers here. I think there's a cultural answer and then there's a operational answer. You know, I think the cultural answer, you know, I just got back last night from our Alpharetta office in Georgia, that's an office that is still kind of culturally getting integrated, and it's a company that did not have a lot of financial discipline. And I said to them, "We are not a company that will ever be run by finance. The companies that are run by finance are not entrepreneurial. But having said that, companies that don't have a strong finance component are out of business." So, you know, being very clear in these messages of wanting to be entrepreneurial, needing to have all of the best practices and compliance in place, but not having that in any way stop us from being entrepreneurial and empowering and transparent. I think you have to talk and you have to support those cultural values all the time. And people have to see that play out all the time so that it is safe to think differently and it is safe to stretch. And on the other hand, I mean, this is a company that does skyscrapers today. I mean, if I don't have the right compliance in place, you know, it could bring the whole thing down. So making sure that those people have a voice at the table. And I do think that, you know, I think being able to pivot as you grow is really important. And if you and I would have been talking at a smaller scale, I would have talked much less about the finance importance. Today, at a different size of scale, with larger lenders, all of that, it's just a different part of the equation. And so you, as a person and a leader, I think have to be able to be adaptable and have to be able to be willing to play all kinds of roles, which sometimes are front and center roles to help the organization and the people in the firm understand what you stand for.
Yeah, so culturally then, I know you also have a co-CEO now. Starting, you did that in 2018?
Yes.
Now that's a cultural change right there. I don't see many organizations that have co-CEOs.
Yes.
What was the idea behind that? And I think it's a very important thing because you were able to set your ego aside because a lot of people that manage companies don't want to share the power. That's important.
I think the idea actually started with the fact that I do like the idea. That I do believe that for our firm to be successful, it's all about collaboration. And what better way to send the message to everybody that it's not about you collaborating, it's about us collaborating, than me being willing to stand shoulder to shoulder with somebody else and the NZ organization. So I thought it was a really important cultural message. It's certainly, you know, I would say that the complexity of last year, bringing in a new CFO, creating an outside board, and for the first time having a co-CEO partner there were parts, but honestly, that were just incredibly challenging and incredibly frustrating. I think I've come through it. My experience with life has been if you look at any experiences and you allow yourself to adapt to what those experiences can teach you, you come out of the other end a much stronger person and better person. And that's been my experience is that, you know, I've gone from a very strong intuition about things that immediately went into a let's act to a strong intuition that I bring to a partner, to a board, to a support network that allows us together to get to the best decisions. And I think Jim and I have sorted out, I think he would agree that I'm probably much better frontline kind of synthesizing things that are new and kind of coming at us. Where our partnership really thrives is once we have all that data, stepping back and assessing how that impacts the vision and where we want to go as a company. I think we people say we went through a bromance, but we, we looked at this, we talked for over a year and a half. We were absolutely sure that in terms of the aspirations of what we wanted to build in a company, we were very aligned. Now, I think once the rubber hit the road, you know, we had different ways of operating that we've been working through. But the fact that we were so aligned from a vision standpoint, and we both were willing to put our ego aside, as you said, was kind of the key.
So what did Joe do prior to this?
Jim. Yes.
Sorry, I wrote it down wrong.
No worries. So Jim was, he was CEO of FRCH.
Okay.
And that was the other thing that was really interesting is if you look at this new company and this company that's about experiences, you know, he was bringing the retail side and I was bringing the office and corporate side. So together our industry knowledge has kind of balanced each other out. They also had some mixed use. I think the part that's been new for both of us is, the size and scale of the architectural stuff that we're doing is far in excess of what either legacy company was doing. And that came from some of the small acquisitions that I did right before we came together, and then the acquisition of WB out of Alpharetta, Georgia. So we were doing very large mixed-use developments now that are, you know, an example of one is Riverton, New Jersey's 400 acres, old Dutch Boy manufacturing plant, 20 miles from Manhattan. So pretty cool stuff.
That is awesome. I think it's important for everyone, since our target audience is primarily young professionals, you bring up how long you guys talked prior to going into business together. Why do you think, or explain that relationship and what you were really trying to figure out before you actually, in a sense, married your partner and went into business together? And why is that so important?
So I think there are a couple of things. I'll tell you the kind of sappy story that I tell a lot about this. So, you know, the first part of what we looked at is, were the businesses compatible? And so we had an internal management committee meeting in Boston where I invited Jim to take his leaders, and we spent a day and a half together getting to know each other at the board level. And so everybody walked away with a lot of excitement about that. And that was the first time I was ever that transparent with my organization about an acquisition that we were looking at. But the magnitude of it was going to be so strong that if there weren't the synergies at the management committee level, I didn't think it would work. So anyhow, we met in Boston. That went extremely well, and there was great enthusiasm about that. And then the next piece was, you know, Jim was trying to assess who I was, and I brought him to one of our better run offices so that he could see the inside of how things worked. And that went well. And then he was trying to assess me. You know, again, I really am a true believer that, you know, transparency is the best way to disarm people. And so Jim wanted to set up this dinner with two of my leaders. So I set up the dinner in New York, and they showed up. Jim showed up, and he says, "Okay, well, where's Ozzy?" And they said, "Well, no, he's not coming. It's just us." And the fact that I would send two of my senior leaders to meet with a potential future co-CEO just blew his mind. And so the final meeting was to sit down and say, how would we work together? And so we kind of hatched this idea of the co-CEO. But the sappy part of the story was, though, we met in New York. I'd been in New York for like two or three days, and I'd gotten a lot colder while I was there, and I didn't have a jacket. And so we're walking back, and Jim was turning off to where he was staying, and I was going to be walking another 10 blocks or so. And I like walking, so I wasn't going to take a cab. And he says, "Don't you have a coat?" And I said, "No." So he takes his scarf off, and he wraps it around my neck, and he kind of sends me on my way. And then when I got home, he texted me and said, "Are you home yet?" So, you know, if you're going to go into one of these, you know, deeply connected relationships, you know, beyond a working style, it just said to me, here was somebody who was a very caring person. Here was a guy that had my back in terms of giving me the scarf off of his neck and making sure that I got home that night. And that just said a lot to me about him as a person.
That's awesome. So two more questions before we go into the quick fire, because have to be respectful of your time. You're running a large company. Yeah. You have to do your job. How do you stay in touch with the entire company? What I mean by that is, how many offices do you say you have?
25.
And they're all around the country, and it's your job to make sure things are going right. How do you stay connected with that?
You know, I think there's no pat answer to that. I, first of all, enjoy being connected in every way that is. So, for instance, we have Facebook at work, and every day I go on Facebook at work, and I try to comment on everything I can that people are doing. So I think that level of you sent me it and I responded within an hour.
Yeah.
That sends a message to people that you're plugged in, that you're from a technology standpoint. I answer every email or call or whatever on the day that I hear from people.
I guess this phone doesn't like silent mode anymore.
That would be one. Two, I travel an awful lot. And in my travels,
I'm almost never, you know, I pick a spot that's out in the studio to sit. I try to walk around as much as I can and talk to people. I really try to make my trips matter in terms of how much I do meet with people, connect with people. Three, I thrive off of kind of interaction with people, and I'm not afraid of hard questions. I believe in what we're doing, and I want that opportunity to have you ask me the hard question about what I'm doing about this or that. So I'm not running from anything. I think a lot of CEOs are uncomfortable with the hard questions, and I would say that, I mean, part of the challenge too is I think in this world of transparency, sometimes leaders are afraid of being caught in positions where something gets on, somebody videos something or, something that was well-intended goes sideways. I don't think you can, you can't live life afraid. Over the years, I've done a number of things. When the company first started to grow, I did a weekly email every Friday that talked about all kinds of different things. It could be what my week was like and where I traveled. It could be somebody in my family died and this is why it was important to me. I saw something this week that I thought was great, or I saw something this week that horrified me. But it was a chance for me to put my voice out there in a way that was very transparent and human and that they could connect with. So, I really look for any of those kind of opportunities to stay very connected to people.
That's awesome. I love that you're willing to humanize yourself, because big, scary CEO can freak some people out,
I love that I went to, last week, this was my second weekend in Atlanta. I was in Atlanta last week. I actually went on a retreat with one of the teams for a day and a half. And before that, I announced that one of the leaders in the company was going to be elevated to a national role. And I wanted to go and quiet the concerns of the team that felt she might be less accessible to them while we celebrate her being elevated. So anyhow, I went to this thing, and then I was going to this retreat in rural Georgia, so I had these cowboy boots on. And the woman that is being promoted is like, I'm like 5'7", and she's like 6 foot. And the joke came from the audience that I had the cowboy boots on to look taller with her, right? But that's when you know that you've created this approachability, is when somebody can make that joke about you in front of 100 people. And I think you're doing something right in terms of, just diffusing the tension that can be there when a senior person in the company visits.
That's awesome. So we ask the same 4 questions to all of our guests at the end. We call them quick fire, but often they turn into something more than quick fire.
They turn into sludge.
So we always have one random question from our audience. So this week's random question is, what is one major change that needs to happen in society today?
Oh, people have got to stop being so polarizing and so stuck in traditional views, whether they're liberal or conservative views. This idea that, now you're going to get me on my soapbox.
Good.
this idea that abortion and gun control should divide a country. This idea that just because you do one thing in your life, that defines the rest of you. Life is becoming far more complicated, and the simple answers don't apply anymore. And we need to be, people just need to be much more open to each other and to the risks of where we are going as a society by being so polarized. It's just so destructive and really dismaying to me.
That's a good one. We actually just had this conversation on our co-working space that we run, because we asked each other, we're like, when do we get to the point? We'll see. I grew up a diehard Catholic, and another one in the space is on the edge of atheist, right? And I was like, when did we get to the point where you and I couldn't actually talk about that subject?
Absolutely.
Like, where did that absurdity come in?
Absolutely. And when did it, I know that, it has been forever, but it's like, when did being Catholic means that you can't open your heart to somebody who's atheist and, you know, exercise your Christianity in embracing someone else, you know?
I agree. People just need to love each other, be willing to have conversations, I think.
Absolutely.
And this is about you, not me, so my bad. So the second question is, what skills does a young professional need to have straight out of college to be successful?
Patience, ambition. I think it's impossible today if you don't have strong technology skills in a broad sense. I remember when I first heard that the phone was going to be the device that you had the camera on and so all these apps were going to be built for the phone at the time. And it's telling you how long ago it was. I was like, the phone? And then they went on to explain, because you're always carrying your phone. And then once I understood that paradigm shift, then it made complete sense. You need to understand technology and all of the changes in paradigms so that you can keep up and advance. And so I think it's conceptual technology and practical technology experience is really important. And the good news is I think most young people have that. And I'd say one other thing. I think for my generation, it was about being willing to do whatever it takes to fit in. I think if there's something I regret about my generation and where we had to be is we had to be adapters more than innovators. I think for young people today, it's about understanding where do you fit and being true to your convictions and your energy.
So before I move on to the next one, I want to dive in really quick to that patience aspect, because I do believe that's something my generation does not really understand. So when you say patience, are we talking 2 days?
Well, and I do think there's a balance between patience and getting bogged down that you never get to your dreams, right? And I would say for me, one of the things that very late in life that I'm coming to appreciate is I'm a very fast processor of data. And now, that doesn't mean that, don't confuse that with intellect, because that means I can get to the wrong answer fast as much as I can get to the right answer fast, but I do get to things fast. In that case, I historically have been frustrated with people who can't get there fast or don't get there fast. I haven't been gracious enough and respectful enough of others' processing skills. I've learned to process things at my speed and then ridicule people that couldn't keep up. That's not leadership, right? So whether it's how fast you process information, what it is that you're trying to accomplish and what's a reasonable time frame, I think it's more about, are you making progress against your goals and objectives and what seems like a reasonable period of time, and then breaking that reasonable period of time into subsets. I think the frustration comes in the moment. It doesn't come in when you look at something and say, I want to build something really big and it's going to take a year. Well, that seems reasonable. Now let's break a year into 52 weeks. And at the end of every week, am I making the progress? So be less patient on the big time frames and more patient on the short time frames is what I would say.
I love that. Really do. I'll have to apply that to my life. The third one is, what do you believe needs to be sacrificed to be successful?
I, again, will give you a very personal answer. Don't sacrifice yourself. The most miserable parts of this journey have been when I sacrificed myself and what I believed in order to advance the cause. Short of that, I do think there are any number of times, and not too long ago, that other people in the company made more money, had a bigger salary than me. There was a time when my wife and I didn't have bank loans, and my family, when it was a family business, didn't understand cash flow. My wife, who was a saint, was ringing out credit card
bills to the tune of $100,000 so that we can make payroll. So, you know, I think there is a difference between people who chase rainbows and people who chase dreams. And I think there are times when you have to make a grounded decision, and you have to be willing to sacrifice what it takes in order to advance those dreams.
A lot of people, I just feel like they don't get to see or hear the struggle that a lot of very successful entrepreneurs have to go through at the beginning. Like, there's a reason you are where you are.
Well, you know, again, I think that's one of the things that's broken about America today is that, you know, you read the headlines and you're either some, you know, greedy capitalist or, you know, you're a good guy or gal, however that's defined. You know, I was having a conversation about the pharmaceutical industry. One of our large clients is Biogen. And, you know, Biogen is building a $1 billion plant right now on a drug that they hope will pass the FDA, right? So now when that happens, guess what? A plant has to be paid for. All that research has to be paid for. All that time at the FDA has to be paid for. So, of course, the pill's going to cost $700 because it's, you know, McDonald's fries don't cost $1.25. That $1.25 is the person serving you the fries, the overhead. You can look at the potato and say it costs 10 cents and you're charging me $1.25 and that's over. I think there's this, when people are successful, there's this lack of willingness to look at what does it take to be successful. What are the constraints around that? You know, in my own case, I've gone from a company that I own 100% and I can do whatever I want, to now having other shareholders and lenders, and I got to go to my board to get a raise. But those sacrifices, in the end, I believe Ron will be right for the company, it'll be right for me, and you have to be willing to integrate that. So my only point is that I think you're absolutely right that yes, there are people that scam the system, and it makes me sick too. But I do think there's a true difference between people who sacrifice and work hard and achieve versus the people who make the headlines, unfortunately, in the Wall Street Journal, who try to scam the system and work greedy.
Yeah. Okay, last question. What is one life hack a young professional should apply to their life this week? What's one actionable task they can take on?
All this time you didn't stump me. Stump me on the last one. there's so many things. You know, I would say maybe think about what makes you unique and where your energy comes from in terms of what you do. I think many times people can kind of be a cog in a wheel and they don't think enough about where do they get their energy, where are they hoping their career goes. You know, is there a real path to where they want to end up, and kind of do this self-actualization around where do they think their skills are, where does their energy come from, and what are they doing today, and are those things aligned in terms of where they want to go in the future?
So how could they do that this week?
This week?
What is one thing that they could try?
I think there's this extra, I think it's the sitting down and this exercise of, you know, it's kind of interesting because I've kind of seen myself, I would say over the years I've been kind of moody because at times I wasn't in tune with where my energy was coming from and I was doing all these things I felt I had to do instead of I wanted to. So one, as you look, you know, just sort of sit down and kind of script this out. What are the things in your current job today that give you energy? And is there enough of those things? Two, what do you think your real skill sets and passion are? And do you get enough of an opportunity to do that? And if you can't answer those two questions, I mean, that in and of itself really requires a lot of self-reflection and self-awareness. And if you can answer those two things, does your career path seem to be taking you in a place that would allow you to maximize both of those?
That's perfect. That is a perfect way to wrap it up. So, Ozzy, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
You. Yeah, me too. Thank you very much.
Hey everyone, this is your host, Bobby Mason, back with you for the closing of the episode. We do this every single week. We break down a couple of reminders to keep them fresh in your mind as you move forward with your week. Maybe you can apply some of these to your life. I highly recommend it. Some reminders from this podcast this week. Number one, the most miserable times of your life will be a result of sacrificing your true self. Never, ever, never sacrifice yourself. Number two, this week, set aside some time to answer these three questions. Question number one, what gives you energy? Question number two, what do you think your real unique skill sets and passions are? And question number three, are you currently on the path to take advantage of your answers to question two and three? If not, it's time for a change. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Masters of the Start. Ozzy was an absolute blast. I hope you loved it as much as I did. And like always, make sure you check us out on social at Masters of the Start. You can find us everywhere. And please do us a big favor. Like us. Leave us reviews on any location that you like to listen to your podcast. And we'll see you next week for episode number 25. Have a great one, everyone.